God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anybody here tonight in their first 30 days of sobriety? We'd just like to welcome you by first name. Feel free to unmute and say hello. Wave at the camera, jump up and down. Nobody? First 30 days? All righty then. Thomas, you first 30 days? Well, welcome. Welcome to everybody. I wonder if I could ask my dear Debbie to read the AA preamble.
Sure. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Debbie. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Thanks.
Thank you, Debbie. The format of this meeting is an open speaker, Ask It Basket. Tonight, we are very excited to have Kathleen E. from Ashburn, Virginia, come and tell her story. After she shares, we'll give her a break somewhere around the top of the hour. We'll call for announcements and pass the seven tradition basket. Then we will ask the questions that you submit. So please, again, feel free to send questions through the chat to the user questions. So very excited to turn it over to Kathleen. Can't wait to hear your story. I appreciate you coming here to share with us tonight. I give you Kathleen.
Thank you, David. Hi, I'm Kathleen Eichenlaub, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, it's great to be here. My sobriety date is January 17th, 1989. My home group is the Midtown Group. We meet on Sunday nights at 7:30. I will miss my home group occasionally to speak somewhere, but not regularly. I have a sponsor, Susie, who knows she's my sponsor because I call her regularly, and I have the privilege of sponsoring Women in Alcoholics Anonymous. I grew up in a fairly normal middle-class family in Baltimore. As it turns out, my dad is alcoholic by his admission. He got sober a couple years before me. He, however, does not go to Alcoholics Anonymous, so he cannot possibly be the same type of alcoholic that I am, because if I were not going to AA and not drinking at the same time, it would not be a pretty picture. And I just as far back as I can remember, felt very weird and very different, you know, and I didn't know what that was about, you know, but I used to get good grades, have extracurricular activities, things like that. And then I took my first drink when I was 11, which of course at the time I thought I was like super cool and mature at 11. But now that I have kids of my own, I have a 20-year-old daughter and a 16-year-old son, I know just how very young 11 actually is, and that's kind of frightening. And I certainly didn't drink every day from age 11, but I did not experience a period of social drinking. From the very beginning, I drank until I blacked out, passed out, threw up, or just couldn't get my hands on anything else, you know? And that from that very first time that I drank, I loved absolutely everything about alcohol. Like, I loved the way it felt when it went down. I loved the way it felt when it hit my gut, and I loved what it did for me, you know, because it took away those feelings of being different and those feelings of being less than, you know, and it didn't just make me feel okay. It made me feel better then, you know, and I just, you know, from the very beginning, I wanted to drink a lot. And of course, you know, you don't drink every day at 11. It's just not really possible. But, you know, I drank at every opportunity I could, and it progressed pretty quickly, you know, and by the time I was in middle school, You know, I was also using other things that affect me from the neck up. I was, you know, hanging out with the wrong crowd. I think I was the wrong crowd, but I was, you know, getting in trouble, getting suspended from school. I think within like the first 18 months that I started drinking, there were no more good grades. There were no more extracurricular activities. Because, you know, when I discovered booze, I also discovered boys. And those were like the only two things I was interested in for a very long time. And, you know, I, like I said, started getting in trouble in school, and it didn't stop. When I turned 16, my dad got me an old Pinto that he repainted bright, shiny red. And I can see some people on here who are so young, you probably don't even know what a Pinto is. Go ahead and Google it. I threatened my daughter a Pinto when she was, you know, not happy. She was getting my old minivan when she turned 16, and she Googled it and thought it looked really cool. I can guarantee you when I was 16, there was nothing cool about it. And you know what? It never occurred to me to not drink and drive. I mean, if you're somebody like me, you know, it's not going to occur to you to like be the designated driver, like not even once. And if you are 16 and you have a car, I mean, like, why would you not drive it? And so I did a lot of, you know, what I call bumper cars, and I would hit cars, and sometimes they were parked and sometimes they were moving. And that's just kind of the way it was. And when I was 17, I came out of a blackout on the Baltimore Beltway as I was hitting a car in the lane next to me. And you know, as drunk as I was, I knew that what I needed to do was I needed to get out of there really fast, because as drunk as I was, I knew that if I were to pull over to the side of the road, which is probably what a normal person would do, that I was going to get into trouble. And, you know, I was always willing to go to any length to keep me from getting into any kind of trouble. And so I sped away from there. And, you know, because I made it home, I thought I'd gotten away with it. And I passed out, and I was woken up the next morning to a bunch of phone calls because the guy I hit got the tag number and called the police, and, you know, they traced it to my dad. And then my dad called me. And, you know, when I got that call that morning, I was still half asleep and I was still half drunk. And the first words out of my mouth with no hesitation were, "I didn't do it," you know, and that's not how my parents raised me, you know, but, you know, what alcohol did for me in a short period of time is it turned me into a person who did whatever I thought was in my best interest without any thought or regard for anybody or anything else, you know? And I ended up having to go to court for that. My dad hired an attorney for me. The attorney explained to me what the word perjury meant and how important it was that I not do that. And I went in and I lied, you know? And I mean, I had no intention of telling the truth. I mean, why are you gonna tell the truth when you know it's gonna give you a consequence that you don't want, right? And so I knew it didn't look good at all, but I thought, what do I have to lose? And what happened to me that day was I went before a judge whose son I had dated, and he let me off, you know? And that's kind of how my drinking went, is that I'd get myself into a little bit of trouble and I'd manage to slide out without getting too big of a consequence, you know? And I went to a public high school, but they're still sending notes home to my parents, you know, saying she's not going to graduate. She's not doing what she needs to do to graduate. And I have a really big ego and I don't like to look bad. And I did what I had to do to get what I wanted. I didn't want to be the one that didn't graduate, you know, and I'm so old that back when I was in high school, they had these things called metal filing cabinets and they put them outside in the hallway. They were locked. I mean, seriously, you could really just kind of pull on it kind of hard to break into it. And inside the metal file cabinets, they had paper tests, you know, and that's where they kept the tests and the answer keys. And so, you know, I just stole some of those so that I could, you know, get by the skin of my teeth and get out of high school. And, you know, I went to college because that's what everybody else was doing. And it's not like I had a lot of choices. Trust me, my grades were bad. My SATs were not good. And not only that, but I was so like unmanageable that I couldn't even figure out like how to apply to college. I mean, like everybody is applying to all these colleges and it's this process. And like, I like don't know what's going on. And, you know, like at the 11th hour after everybody already knows where they're going, you know, I applied to this one little school on the Eastern Shore of Maryland because my mom worked with a bunch of people that had gone there. And so they wrote letters for me and, you know, and I got in. And on the first day of college, as I was, you know, being driven there by my parents, it was my 18th birthday that day. And I was having this conversation with myself about like how I used to get good grades and I used to have, you know, do extracurricular activities, but somewhere along the line, I kind of got off track. But now I'm 18, I'm an adult, I'm going to college, like things are going to be different now, you know, and I really meant it, you guys, I really did. I mean, I have the best of intentions, you know, and I got to tell you that the first night at college, I was falling down the back steps of a fraternity house drunk, and it did not get any better after that. My nickname in college was Kathy from Hell, and that pretty much sums it all up. You know, when I drink, I'm not cute, I'm not pretty, I am anything but a lady. And, you know, it is pretty miraculous that not only that I didn't like hurt myself badly or die from my drinking escapades, but also just because, you know, I mean, I put myself in a lot of bad situations and bad places, and I have a really big mouth too. And I don't really care who you are or what you look like. I'm going to tell you what I think, you know, and that's just not very smart. And, you know, my first semester in college, I got 2 C-minuses, a D and an F. And when you get grades like that, they put you on what they call academic probation. And, you know, this school that I went to was so tough that all you had to do was like get all C's to get off academic probation. And so, you know, I would do just good enough to get all C's and I'd get off academic probation. And then that semester, I wouldn't care anymore. And I get really bad grades again. And then I get back on academic probation. And that was like my whole college career. And, you know, I'd have to go to summer school and whatnot to like make up classes. And, you know, my senior year in college, I was voted the third top female partier in my school. Now, I want you to know that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has really worked in my life, because it's probably only been in the last, I don't know, maybe 10, 12 years that I've said what I said the way I said it, which is the God's honest truth. Because prior to that, I used to say one of the top three, because really I was pissed that I wasn't at least number two, if not number one. The truth is I was number three, you know, and, that was going to be my claim to fame at college, because it wasn't going to be anything else, you know. And, you know, I did try when my first year in college, like, remember how I said, like, I used to have extracurricular activities. So I was like, well, maybe that's what I need to, you know, kind of straighten me out or whatever. And so my freshman year in college, I was a cheerleader, and all I was a drunk cheerleader. You know, I mean, it didn't help me at all, you know, and all we cheered for was basketball. And I didn't even understand how the game went. I mean, you were supposed to understand the game so you could start the appropriate cheer. And I could never start a cheer because I did not understand how. I mean, I understood you were supposed to get the ball in the basket, but that was about the gist of it, you know? And my daughter played basketball for many years. And I grew to love the game of basketball, but it did not happen when I was a cheerleader. And you know, now we've got me a senior in college, and now we've got the deans of the college sending notes home to my parents saying she's not going to graduate. She's not doing what she needs to do to graduate. And once again, I have a really big ego and I don't like to look bad. And so I did what I had to do to get what I wanted, because I didn't want to be the one that didn't graduate. And, you know, I was a psychology major, which I'm sure is shocking. And, you know, at the school I went to, you had to do a thesis, an undergraduate thesis. And so, of course, I picked the psychology professor who I partied with. You know, I babysat his son and he paid me with drugs. I mean, I'm not interested in professors who do their job the way they're supposed to, right? And so, and once again, like everything's at the 11th hour with me. I mean, everybody is completely done with their thesis. They're like, now they're enjoying themselves and I haven't even started, you know? And so, they make the intro psych students participate in so many of these things to help, you know, the seniors with their theses. And I waited so long that all the freshmen had already like done the number that they had to do. And they weren't interested in helping me out of the kindness of their heart. And so like nobody signed up to like participate. And so, you know, I took my questionnaires on the roof of a fraternity house with a picture of kamikazes. I mean, you know, there are ways around everything, you know? And so I handed out shots and they filled out the questionnaire. So I'm certain that my study is very valid, you know? And then I took the questionnaires and I handed them to the professor because I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know what I was supposed to do with it. I didn't know anything. And, you know, you needed to have statistical formulas that you plugged into a computer and out came results. Well, I had no idea how to do that, you know? And so I gave them to him and now I go back to do what I was supposed to do in September, which is the background research that you do in order to even come up with this idea for your study. And of course, what am I doing? I'm copying things word for word out of books, you know? And so now I take this part, I go over to the psychology building and I show up with two guys who are exactly like me. They like to party, they have waited till the last minute and here they come and they have the same thesis advisor that I do. And we were greeted by the head of the department, a man who does his job the way he's supposed to do. And he looked at us and he said, I've got bad news for you guys. You know, your thesis advisor has had a nervous breakdown and he's in the state mental hospital. I'm your new thesis advisor. And the three of us put our heads together and came up with a keen alcoholic idea, which only alcoholics can do. Because we knew that if that man was our thesis advisor, we were not going to graduate, you know? And so we came up with this great idea. We took our theses, we jumped in the car, and we drove to the state mental hospital. And we met our professor and we said, we know you're having a hard time right now, but like, we need your help, you know? And so he continued to be our thesis advisor from the state mental hospital. And so we graduated, you know? I did not deserve it, but I will take it, you know, and he did get out in time for graduation, by the way. And, you know, another thing that was happening at the end of my drinking was that I was having these terrible anxiety attacks for like, I don't know, probably the last year of my drinking. And to me, the solution to that was to drink, you know, and I mean, there were certainly a lot of people, places and things throughout the course of my drinking that tried to tell me that had a problem with alcohol, you know, and they might as well have been telling me that my problem was I had polka dot hair, which I didn't have. Now, I knew I had a problem, but it's really hard to find the right solution for your problem when you don't really know what the problem is. And as far as I was concerned, alcohol wasn't my problem. It was the solution to my problems. Like my problems are you and them and him and it and the thesis advisor and the mental hospital and all the other stuff, you know, and so, you know, whatever, like you want to say to me, it's not, you're not right, you know? And so, you know, these anxiety attacks, the last year of my drinking and the best I can describe them is it felt like I was stoned out of my mind and yet I was sober, you know? And so the only thing I know to do when I feel like that is to take a drink, you know? And I can tell you that because I never thought I had a problem with alcohol, I never wanted to quit. I didn't. You know, however, I would have, you know, those days, you know, where I'd wake up in the morning and I'd have, you know, not only the, you know, the physical pain of the hangover, but the emotional pain of the guilt and the remorse and the shame. And, you know, and so many times where like I had to have somebody fill in the blanks for me, you know, like I'd think to myself, like, I remember going to the bar and I remember ordering the second drink, but like what happened after that? Like I must have come home really early because remember, I'm the third top female partier in the school. And so I can drink a lot, right? So like what happened, you know? And sometimes I'd find out that like I was in the bar until it closed, you know? And I'd think to myself, like, how could somebody that could drink like me, like black out after the second drink, you know? And I always had a rationalization for it, you know, like I didn't proof down or I didn't eat enough before I went out or, you know, a couple of times I swore somebody slipped me a Mickey, you know, and my favorite excuse was, you know, I had so much alcohol left in me from the night before that, you know, tonight it only took a little bit to kind of like re-trigger all of that. And I get drunk faster, you know, and, you know, the truth of the matter is that, you know, what I just described is powerless over alcohol, because I have no idea what's going to happen once I start drinking, you know. Maybe I'll start drinking at 3 o'clock on Friday afternoon and play drinking games and keep on going and, you know, not stop until 6 a.m. on Saturday morning and only stop because there's nothing left, you know, and remember the whole night, you know, and nights like that, I think like, yes, you know, like this is how I want to drink every single day. Like I got it, you know, and then there'd be, you know, the nights where, you know, I'd go out all dressed up to some fancy thing and I'd end up putting my hand through a window at some point. Or, you know, like the night I went out with my stepsister in the Inner Harbor in Baltimore, because at the time our parents lived there, and we went out because I was pissed at my mom, and we went out for two drinks, you know, and I woke up the next morning on a boat in the Inner Harbor with a guy who was the best friend of my boyfriend's brother, and my stepsister was nowhere to be found, you know, and now I got to hightail it back home in the morning and sneak in the house to find out that she also just snuck back in the house from somewhere else. And we don't know where our parents' car is, and we got to go find it, you know? And so just stuff like that all the time, you know, and not being able to predict with any certainty, like what's going to happen when I start drinking. And, you know, so, you know, like I said, I did get out of college and, I was looking for a job. I didn't care what kind of job it was. And, you know, I was on my way to what was to be my first night working like as a waitress somewhere. And on my way there, you know, you probably had to be there at like, I don't know, 3 or 4 for like the dinner shift. And on my way there, I hadn't had a drink yet that day. And I was just completely overcome by feelings of insanity. You know, I thought like, if anybody knew like what went on inside of here, they'd throw me away in a padded cell, like, and throw away the key. I just literally had ceased being able to function sober, you know? And so the best I could do that time was to turn the car around and go home. And, you know, of course, not call the work and say, I'm not coming, just never talk to them again. And, you know, which then of course led me to, now I got to start looking for a job again. And I ended up getting a job in a drug and alcohol treatment center, which, you know, of course my friends and I at the time thought that was pretty funny. And, you know, but I have no doubt in my mind that my higher power chose to take me there, because I was 22 years old and I thought that an alcoholic was the old man laying in the gutter wearing a trench coat and drinking out of a paper bag. And I thought, you cannot be alcoholic if you're 22 years old and you graduated from college and you haven't been arrested and so on and so forth, you know? And so I started working there, and I stole a bunch of literature. I took the 20 questions was one of the pieces of literature I stole. I took the 20 questions and I did not pass. And I decided, you know, that what that meant was I had a potential problem with alcohol if I continued to drink, and that I'm just going to stop. Like, I thought that self-knowledge was going to be the answer, you know? And I thought, I don't need to get sent to a treatment center to stop drinking. I'm just going to stop on my own, you know? And so I tried to do that, you know? And so for the first time in my life, I was the designated driver. I thought I might stop drinking, but I wasn't willing to change anything else in my life. You know, everybody went bye-bye.
Okay, you're back now.
Okay, yeah. So all I heard was what was different between you and me. You know, it seemed like everybody that shared was like a 90-year-old man, and he'd lost his, you know, his house and his job and his wife and his kids and his dog and his cat. And I just did not relate, you know. And there were a bunch of people, members of Alcoholics Anonymous, that worked at this treatment center, you know. And, you know, when I'm, you know, the alcoholic trying to hide it from people, I think I'm fooling everybody, you know. But the truth of the matter is that we can smell each other a mile away, you know, and I wasn't fooling anybody, you know. And I heard what was going on. I was listening to what was going on. And, you know, these people, you know, that went to AA, not only did they not drink, you know, but they had these sponsors who, it sounded like they were people who told you what to do. And, you know, and they wanted you to like get out of yourself and help other people. And, you know, the thing that sounded the worst to me was that for fun, they went bowling. And I thought like, oh my God, like you want me to not drink and go bowling? Like, oh my gosh, like my life is over, you know? And so that's why I tried to stop drinking on my own, because I didn't want any part of that, you know? And yet, you know, I stayed dry and crazy for 90 days. And, you know, shocker, on day 91, because I was out at a bar, you know, I ended up doing something else that affects me from the neck up, you know? And I've been seeing a therapist because, again, I'm seeking for something to fix this problem, although I don't really know what the problem is, you know. And so I just remember, you know, that I'd been telling the therapist like that I wasn't drinking. And so I felt like you were supposed to tell your therapist like everything. And so I said, well, yeah, I mean, I did like do this other thing, but like, it doesn't matter because like, I just said I wasn't drinking, you know? And there were many, many, many things I tried to fix me. You know, I tried not drinking on my own. I tried going to church. I tried other religious organizations. I tried other 12-step programs. In late 1988, early 1989, I was told there were 76 12-step programs. I tried a few of them, just not AA, you know. I used to love to go to the self-help section in the bookstore and buy books for my various afflictions because I have many, you know. And I tried being healthy and exercising. I tried staring at candles, and nobody told me this, but I thought you were supposed to stare at a candle in the dark and wait for God to literally speak to you, you know. Now, if that had actually happened, that definitely would have been cause to take a drink. So luckily, you know, that did not happen. But like, none of the things that I tried worked, you know? And so, you know, as everything kind of came screeching to a halt all at the same time, you know, me using something else and all of these other things that I tried not working and all of these anxiety attacks and me just feeling like I was completely Looney Tunes, is what got me really, really desperate, you know? And on that day, you know, one of these people who was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, this woman who at the time was sober 5 years, which just seemed like an eternity to me, you know, she was listening to me moan about whatever I was moaning about that day. It was always something, you know, and she just looked at me and she said, you know what, Kathleen, it doesn't have to be that way anymore. And I don't know why, but I heard that. I had been to a handful of meetings, but this was the first thing I really heard. And I knew that she was telling me the truth, but I also knew that if I wanted things to be different, that I was going to have to actually come to Alcoholics Anonymous and do the things that you people were talking about, you know? And so I came to AA desperate, which is a really good way to come, you know? And coming desperate for me does not mean that I was happy to be here or that I was a rocket to stardom, because neither of those things is true, you know? I continued to have anxiety attacks for the first 11 months of my sobriety, but I literally was out of ideas for where to go or what to do. So I thought, if this doesn't ever go away, oh well, you know. And I mean, I got sober in Baltimore, where most meetings were, you know, discussion meetings, and there was none of this raising your hand and volunteering stuff. Like, whoever was leading the meeting called on you. And you know, I'm such an egomaniac with an inferiority complex that, you know, being brand new, I might be at a meeting where some man I've never met before is celebrating 40 years of sobriety, and there's 100 people in the room, and I'm sitting all the way in the back, but I just know he's going to call on me, you know? I mean, that is how I am. And so at every meeting I went to, I sat as far in the back as I could, and I tried to sit behind somebody really tall so that I would be invisible. And what I was doing is I was sitting on my hands, you know, and I just really felt like I might at any moment just, you know, involuntarily leap out of my chair and go running, screaming out the door. Like, that's how crazy I felt. And, you know, I told anybody that would listen to me, do not ever call on me in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, or I will never speak to you again. Like, that was some awful threat, you know? And I was able to carry on that way for, I think, like maybe 5.5 months or something, until one day somebody leading the meeting did not know my rule and they called on me, you know, and I had been around long enough that I had heard, do what you're asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how we stay sober, you know? And so when that person called on me, you know, I couldn't believe it. I was shocked that I said, you know, I'm Kathleen and I'm an alcoholic. And then I said maybe like a 4-word sentence that probably didn't make any sense at all. But the point is I did what I was asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and God, that has held me in good stead, you know, still to this day, you know. And I can tell you that literally every step I took and every sponsor direction I took knowing with every fiber of my being that it was not going to work for me. I mean, literally, you know, and so when I looked at the first step, I mean, I hear most people talk about having a problem with the unmanageability aspect of it. And I didn't have a problem with that. I mean, my life was completely and totally a wreck and completely and totally unmanageable. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I'd say to myself in the morning, like, just today is going to be the day where I actually like take a shower before noon, go to all the places I'm supposed to go at the time I'm supposed to go. And just today, I'm not going to drink. You know, but what was happening with me, especially in that last year, is that, like I said, I couldn't function sober anymore. And so something would always happen, whether it was 8 o'clock in the morning, 8 o'clock at night, or somewhere in between, where I could not stand the way it felt to be inside my skin sober. And I knew if I could just get a drink of alcohol that I was going to be okay. And so that's what I would do. You know, the problem is for me is that once I take one drink, I get really thirsty. And just all bets are off, you know? And so my life was unmanageable. That was really clear to me. However, I did not believe that you could be powerless over liquid in a bottle. As a matter of fact, I could tell you many stories about how when I drank, I got very powerful. You know, we were in Ocean City for Beach Week. And I don't know, my three roommates weren't there. I was there by myself playing loud music and drinking. And, you know, I guess there were complaints and the people came to the door and told me to open the door and I wouldn't open the door, you know? And so these two big guys tried to push in the door and I held it back. And, you know, they swore there were multiple people holding the door back. And I was like, no, I was by myself. Just kick me out. Don't kick out the other three people, you know? And so I like showed up on the doorstep of a place that my other friends were, which I mean, well, you wouldn't leave Beach Week and go home. I mean, come on. You know, and doing that, I met this guy upstairs from them who became my next boyfriend. His name was Rocky. I mean, that's just a whole nother story. But anyway, you know, so I did not believe I was powerless over alcohol. And I thought like, whatever, like I'm good, I'm unmanageable. And this is how everything for me was always like the Reader's Digest version, you know, and thank God my sponsor, like, made me do a written first step. And thank God that the old timers were saying things like, you know, the first step is the only step you have to get 100%. You know, like you cannot be just 99% powerless over alcohol, which I think are great odds, by the way. But they said, you know, if that's your belief, then something in life is going to happen. And that 1% that doesn't believe you're powerless is going to pick up a drink, you know, and so she had me do a written first step, and it had nothing to do with the crazy stuff I did. But what came out when I was writing is what I've already described to you, which is that number one, I can't say with any certainty, I'm not going to drink just today, you know, and actually be able to do that. And I also can't predict with any certainty what's going to happen when I do start drinking. You know, maybe I'll act like a lady the whole night, or maybe I'll go out for New Year's Eve with three friends in DC, because I didn't get grandfathered into the state of Maryland when the drinking age went from 18 to 21, but DC stayed 18. And we went into DC and we got a hotel and we went out to the bars and they were done and I wasn't. And I said, see ya, you know, and I woke up in some godforsaken place in some terrible neighborhood in DC, you know, and so who knows? I just don't know. It's going to be fun though. I can promise you that, you know, but so I'm glad that she had me do a written first step so that I could see that I am truly 100% powerless over alcohol. And I still believe that to this day. I don't think that because I haven't had a drink in a while, that things would be okay if I picked up. As a matter of fact, you know, over the years, I've seen a lot of people who had a period of sobriety and they went out to drink. And then when they came back, what they said was, it was like they had never stopped drinking. And if that's the case, then that is really seriously scary, which means it would really be bad for me, you know? So I still believe I'm powerless over alcohol 100%, you know? And so just literally every step I took, I was like, this is not going to work for me. Like, and, you know, I had those anxiety attacks, my first 11 months of sobriety. And again, I wasn't really hopeful that they were going to stop, you know, but they did stop, you know, and that was a good definition of sanity for me, you know, because when I looked at step two, I thought like, you know, restored to me implies some kind of going back to a previous time. And I thought, well, I don't know. Like, I felt insane when I was 5. I felt insane when I was 10. Like, what are you going to restore me to, you know? And what I was told was that if I worked the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would start to see some sanity come into my life, you know? And I honestly didn't believe that was going to happen. But I believed it when those anxiety attacks stopped, you know? And, you know, I grew up with a loving God. So like an idea of a loving God was not a problem. However, what was a problem was thinking that I was going to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, you know? And I mean, they said all those witty things like, take a look at the mirror and see what a great job you've been doing of, you know, running your life. Like, yeah, that's awesome, you know, but I just still thought like, if I'm not running the show, like, what am I going to be like, the hole in the donut, you know? And besides, I literally had no willingness to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And so what they told me to do was to pray for the willingness. And I thought, that is the dumbest thing I have ever heard. You know, now I didn't say any of these things. I mean, if you talk to people that knew me when I was new, they would say she was very quiet and very sweet, but I was thinking all kinds of stuff like, you all are crazy. I don't even want to be here, but okay, I'll pray for willingness. And then when it doesn't work, I'll get to leave because I'll get to prove that I'm the one person that this program is not going to work for, because don't you know, I'm terminally unique. You know, Clancy always used to say like, it's the death cry of alcoholics is that you don't understand, my case is different because now I'm different from you, you know? And you know, I started praying for the willingness, you know, and of course, then they tell you, you know, again, more witty things like, you know, if there's 3 frogs on a lily pad and one of them makes a decision to jump off, how many are on the lily pad? Well, there's still 3 because one only made a decision. He didn't actually jump. And so, you know, part of the third step is you have to go on into your 4th step, you know, and I had come into Alcoholics Anonymous with a couple of what I thought were, you know, terrible, deep, dark secrets, things that nobody else had done. And I thought, all right, I'll do this, you know, 4th step, but I'm not, that stuff's not going to go on there, you know? And yet they said to me, pray before you start writing your 4th step. And so I prayed and I started writing and I could not believe that those things came off the pen and onto the paper, you know? And I thought, well, that's fine that it's on the paper, but I don't have to read that part when I do my 5th step, you know? And then I was told to say a prayer before I did my 5th step, you know, and I said a prayer and I could not believe that those things came out of my mouth, you know, and of course, like my sponsor had done the same exact things, you know, and so I got to find out like that my case really isn't so different after all, you know, and now my first sponsor was very sweet and kind and loving. And so when I read my inventory to her, she said things to me like, oh, honey, you weren't that bad. Now, she did not say, you have no character defects and no amends to make, but that's what I heard, because she said, you're not that bad, you know? And so I did my 5th step like right before I turned a year sober. And where I got sober, they were not only telling you what you needed to do in your first year, they were telling you what you needed to not do in your first year. And I was so scared and again, had anxiety attacks for most of my first year of sobriety, that I believed them, you know? And so now look, let me be honest. So I didn't date. It's not because I didn't try. I tried and I just was too busy having anxiety attacks. And like one day I walked out to meet this guy and I literally just kept walking and walked past him. I mean, I just was, you know, sober and having anxiety attacks. And it was just not, you know, so it's not like patting myself on the back that I didn't date in my first year, but you know, all these things I wasn't doing in my first year. In my sick head, even though nobody said this, I thought, well, if you're telling me don't do them in your first year, then what you must mean is that like on day 365, you're good to go, right? And so I had a year and a day and I had my first date, you know, and not long after that, I switched jobs. And not long after that, I moved to a different place, you know? What happened in my second year of sobriety, and I never meant for this to happen, is that very slowly, Alcoholics Anonymous started having less and less importance in my life, because now I had this guy, I had this job that I loved, and I was spending a lot of time there. And so little by little, what I was doing in Alcoholics Anonymous was getting smaller and smaller. And I found out, you know, that if you stop doing what you're doing, you stop getting what you're getting, you know? And so I did not pick up a drink, but I was just as completely bat crap crazy at, you know, 2+ years of sobriety as I had been the day that I walked in here, you know? And I was living with and engaged to this goof I met in Alcoholics Anonymous. And why? Because he asked, you know? Now, when he asked, my insides were screaming, scream no and run the other way. And what came out was, okay, like, it was just not good. You know, I am fantasizing on a daily basis that maybe he'll cross the street and get hit by a truck, right? Because I have no skills to know how to I don't know how to end this, right? And so I'm thinking things or that I might run away, you know, because this is how I'm going to get out of something, you know? And so what happened was literally the only commitment I had left in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I was involved in the Maryland State Convention, and I was hosting a speaker from Los Angeles, a woman by the name of Karen Garrison, who has since passed away. And I spent the weekend with her. She asked me a lot of questions about my program, and I had all the wrong answers, you know, and I found myself at the end of the weekend asking her to sponsor me. And I thought, oh my gosh, if you're not using the sponsor that lives down the street, what are you going to do with one that lives across the country? You know, and I definitely don't recommend that, but I needed her. I needed somebody that was really, I did not need another kind and gentle sponsor. What she was a mean old timer. That's what she was. And, you know, she rattled off this list. Like when I asked her to sponsor me and she said, yes, she rattled off this long list of what she was going to expect from me. Quite frankly, all the same things they told me to do when I was brand new. And I thought to myself, did she not hear me? Like, I've been sober for over 2 years. And that's not what I said. What I said was, okay, you know. And so I started doing this stuff again in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, like shocker, I became sane again from working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And she had me do another fourth and fifth step. And as I'm reading my fifth step to her, she did not say, oh, honey, you weren't that bad. She called me a liar, cheat, and a thief, and a couple of other names too. And she had me sit there with paper and pen, and she'd stop me every now and again. And she'd have me writing on 2 different pieces of paper. And by the time I was done, I had a list of all my character defects and I had a list of the amends I had to make. And I'm going to tell you that right before I did that fifth step with her, I was in a meeting that was on either 8 or 9. And I remember thinking, it's really great you guys have those steps, but it just doesn't apply to me. Like, I am not going to owe anybody any amends. I mean, I did all that stealing in college, but it's their stupid fault for like leaving their dorm room unlocked or leaving their clothes in the laundry room, you know? And I walked away from there with 76 names on my 8th step list. And I had to add names since then because, you know, you always have like, you know, somebody tells you a story and you completely forgot. Like it was really lovely with quite a few years of sobriety when my sister-in-law was telling a story in front of my family about how I locked someone in a porta potty at this like outdoor, you know, drunk fest is what it was. And I had no recollection of that, you know, and there were things like that that happened. But so I had those 76 names on that list and she made me start making amends the very next day. And I was like, whoa, what happened to like, where's like 6, 7, and 8, you know? And she goes, well, you go home, read those 2 paragraphs in the big book, make sure you didn't leave anything out. And then this is the amend you're gonna make tomorrow. And I was like, wait, 8 says I have to be willing. Yeah, I'm not willing. And she's like, I don't really care if you're willing, you ought to be willing. You go take that action and eventually your thoughts and feelings will catch up with you. And I thought, okay, she's crazy, you know, and where are the AA police, by the way, because this is not right, you know? And I talked to everybody who would listen to me to say, don't you think she's wrong? And I could not get one person to agree with me, you know? And the problem is that for my whole entire life, including for a couple of years in AA, what willingness meant to me was have an overwhelming desire to do something. And as a result, I didn't do very much because I didn't get an overwhelming desire to do much more than what I thought was going to please me, you know? And so sponsorship has been incredibly important to me the entire time I've been here. But I have to say that I believe that it is supremely important when it comes to making amends, because left to my own devices, I am going to not make amends to people I need to make amends to. And I'm going to try to go make amends to people that I really just need to stay away from. And so, you know, she gave me very explicit directions with each amend I had to make. And she made me start with my father, which at the time I was mortified. In hindsight, it was genius because it was a really hard one, you know, and she told me what I needed to say. And I said, but you don't understand. Like, I think I'm going to cry and I can't cry. Like, it's just not okay. Like, that's what I was taught growing up. At least that's what I think I was taught growing up. And she said, it doesn't really matter. And I talked to a whole bunch of people about that too. And they said, it doesn't really matter, you know? And so I went to talk to my dad, and, you know, my dad is somebody who I respected and I loved, but I didn't like him very much. And I didn't think he liked me very much. We were very, very different. And if you'd asked me when I got to AA to make a list of 100 things I wanted, a better relationship with my dad would not have made the list. And not because I didn't want it, because I literally thought it was impossible, you know, impossible. And I made these amends to my dad, and my worst fear came true. I cried, you know, and I mean, you know, there were many things I had to go over with him, and including that attorney, and he swore there was no attorney, which, you know, I was a drunk, but there was an attorney, trust me. And, you know, and he said to me, you know, he goes, all I know is you just always seem so unhappy. And I was like, well, yeah, I mean, I, you know, was an active alcoholic. He's no, I mean, from when you were really, really little. And that was actually very depressing to me. Like, so I did not walk away from that amend with my father feeling good in any way, shape or form. As a matter of fact, I was like, here it is. Here's that step where I'm going to be the one that this does not work for, you know? Now, what happened though, is that, first of all, I have to say, I believe strongly that I needed to make direct amends. Grant you, there was no Facebook when I got sober, but I don't believe it means on Facebook. I believe it means direct. But I was also taught that not only do I make the direct amends, but that I have to continue to make living amends. So in other words, I don't say, sorry, I was a shitty daughter, and then continue to be a shitty daughter. And by the way, I also love the analogy that when I start drinking, that's when I stop growing emotionally. So basically, when I got to you at 22, I was about the emotional age of an 11-year-old, you know, and I had missed a whole lot of lessons along the way. And so being a good daughter had to be explained to me, because I honestly didn't know how to do that. And so, you know, she said, you're going to call him every week. You're going to ask him how he's doing. You're going to tell him how you're doing. And then before you get off the phone, you're going to say, I love you. And I was like, oh, we don't say that in my family. No, we don't. She's like, well, you do now. And I just thought this, she was the meanest woman on the planet, you know? But I did what she said to do, you know? And what happened was my dad started to change right before my very eyes, you know? It's amazing, you know? And we have a great relationship today. You know, I talked to him earlier today. I call him every Sunday. When I got married, he threw this amazing wedding for us. And I thought we were having a daddy-daughter dance. And nobody knew, not even my stepmother, but he like sat me down, handed me a handkerchief, and sang a song to me. And I just, you know, bawled all my makeup off. And, you know, when he had to be in the hospital several years ago, having you know, first some planned surgery and then some emergency, not planned surgery, you know, I knew what to do because I had watched you all do it, you know. Now at the time, okay, so I'm 54 now. I was probably, I don't know, 42, 44, somewhere around there. But I still, even to this day, I do not, being a grown-up does not come naturally, and I don't like being a grown-up. And so still, when difficult things happen, I'm going like this, where are the grown-ups? Like, when are the grown-ups coming? Like, you cannot mean me, you know? And I don't mind like hard work in like the manual labor sense of hard work, but I don't like hard and uncomfortable and awkward feelings, you know? And so, but like, I did what I watched you all do, you know, and I drove, so the Reader's Digest version is, I moved to Los Angeles at 5 years of sobriety to be with that sponsor. I met a man because I was active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then he got transferred here to Northern Virginia, almost 13 years ago. And so, you know, my kids were little, I'd get sitters and I would go up and see him like every other day and spend time with him and talk to him and give my stepmother some relief. And, you know, and then he had something crazy happen like the day he was to leave and like had to, he almost died, you know, and had this emergency surgery, you know, and my stepsister called to tell me because she was, you know, closer in location and it was not good, you know, and I mean, I have prayed from the beginning of my sobriety, but like, I don't know. I think that's when I really learned that prayer really is an action. Like, I want to do, go, you know, and this happened late at night when my husband was out of town and I'm an hour and a half away and I have little kids asleep, you know, and I couldn't go do something. All I could do was pray, you know, and it was a rough road out of that, you know, but again, I kept showing up, you know, and, you know, I told you that this is a man who said to us growing up, you don't cry, like crying shows weakness. Now that's just my crazy perception, you know, because when my dad, well, first he was conscious, but he was intubated and he would like write on this blackboard and he'd be like, what happened? And I'd tell him the whole long, sad story and we could only go in one at a time. So then I'd go out and somebody else would come in and then eventually I'd go back in and he'd write on the whiteboard, what happened? Because he couldn't remember it. So I had to keep telling the story. But when he finally got that tube out and I was the first person he saw, he just started crying, you know? And so I think perhaps my perception might've been off, you know? I know my perception was off about pretty much everything, you know? And so, you know, I have some really cool, amazing stories about making amends. And then I have some that weren't so awesome, you know? I treated my stepsister horribly, you know? One night she just wouldn't stop. And I like called off and hit her because she wouldn't shut up, you know? And because I did that, I then did not speak to her for a long time because that's just the delightful creature that I am, you know? And that did not just affect her. It affected every member in my family because trust me, if I'm mad at someone, like everybody in like a 5 mile radius is going to know about it, you know? And so that behavior to my stepsister had to be part of my amends to like everybody in my immediate family, you know? And when I made amends to my stepsister, I mean, you would think that I was like giving her $1 million. It was like insane how gracious she was with me, you know? But when I made amends to her brother, it was a very kind of cold reception. And really what it was kind of like a, we'll wait and see what happens kind of a thing, you know? And thankfully, like I said, I was taught, you know, that I have to make living amends, you know, and my stepsister was in my wedding and today we're very close, you know? And like I said, I moved out to Los Angeles. I literally could give you a 1 hour talk on the batshit crazy men I met in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I met crazier and crazier men in Alcoholics Anonymous than I ever did when I was drinking, but we do not have time for that tonight. But let's just say that my husband is the first man that I actually got to know first and decided was a good human being before I decided to date him. You know, prior to that, it was, could be an axe murderer and they kind of have that personality, but we're going to go with this because it seems exciting, you know? And so, you know, my husband and I have been married, almost 22 years. And, you know, we have a 20-year-old daughter, a 16-year-old son. And life happens, people. I mean, you know, nobody said that just because I'm sober that life was going to be easy, you know? And yes, I've had wonderful things happen, you know, like getting married and having kids and just the friendships in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like I have two of the best girlfriends anybody could ever ask for. And they've both been my friends for like 27 years, you know, and despite living across the country, like they are still my closest friends, you know, but life happens, you know. And I mean, we've had sponsors die. We've had, you know, my husband's mother tragically die in a car accident. We had his father die from cancer a year and a half ago. My husband, who at the time was 49 and insanely healthy, got cancer. It was so crazy, you know, and yet I was able to see the blessings in it instead of just the nightmare, you know, because he had a tumor growing on his spine and it caused him to become numb in his legs, which is what got us to the hospital. And if it had grown in the other direction, wouldn't have got us to the hospital, you know. And it was, you know, a very easily treatable cancer. So 4 months later, he was in remission, you know, but that was a challenging time, I have to say, you know. But what I learned from watching all of you is that I needed to lean into Alcoholics Anonymous and all of those things, you know. And we've had challenges in our marriage. We've had challenges with both of our kids. You know, this is not like I'm sober, you're sober, everything's hunky-dory. It's not like that, you know. And but I've watched you all and I've learned that I have to lean into the program when I'm going through these things, you know. And sometimes when things are tough, what I want to do is push everybody away and go, I've got this. Let me just be miserable all by my little self, because really, again, my case is different. Like, you don't understand, you know. But I've leaned in anyway, you know. I've leaned in. I've been willing to look bad and cry and ask for help and accept help, you know. I mean, when my husband had cancer, I have a friend who's not in AA but knows I'm in AA, and I'd be like sitting at the hospital and my husband would be sleeping and I'd just be sitting there, and he'd be texting me going, I'm really worried about you that you're sitting there all by yourself and nobody's calling you or texting you. And I was like, like, you have no idea. Like, AA is better than the Harvard Alumni Association. Like, my phone is blowing up constantly, you know? And, you know, my phone rang so much that sometimes I couldn't pick up the phone. I couldn't pick up every call. And one time a friend of mine called, and he has more time than me, and I said, this is so weird, like, all these people. And he's like, Kathleen, you and Aaron have been doing this for 30 years. Like, it's your turn to receive it, you know. And so we had to let people do that, you know, and that's what people did, you know. And I'll be honest with you, I don't know how people get through deaths and cancer and the pandemic without this program. I really don't know, you know. And as it turns out, I was right all those years ago when I said, like, alcohol is not my problem, you know, because I've been sober for 32 years and alcohol has not been my problem for 32 years, but I still have alcoholism. It's up here. It's live and well and up here. And that's what my problem is. My problem is alcoholism, you know, and it's only treated through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and sometimes very imperfectly. You know, I don't want to ever pretend like I do this perfectly or I do it gracefully. I very often do it very, very, very ungracefully, you know, but I keep doing it. And that's the most important thing. So if you're new, I really want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. It isn't always easy, but it is simple. And if you stay in the middle of the herd, then you can't, you know, get picked off the edges by a wild animal. So I hope you all stay. And I want to thank you all so much for having me tonight.
Oh, thank you, Kathleen. Thank you so much. Everybody's allowed to unmute and thank Kathleen.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you.
Kathleen.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Thank you, ma'am, very much. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All righty. I'm going to take it back and we'll give Kathleen a little break and we'll do some business here. And I'll just remind everybody, please, if you have a question, please, it's a good opportunity to throw it into the chat to the user questions. The seventh tradition, I placed some links in the chat. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. Are there any announcements tonight for the good of AA? You're allowed to unmute.
Hey guys, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Ebony.
Ebony!
Norfolk District 14 is hosting a 12 concepts workshop. We have 12 steps, 12 traditions, and 12 concepts. If you don't know what the concepts are, it's all right. Neither do I. That's why I go to the workshop. We do one concept a month on the fourth Wednesday at 7 p.m. So this month, April the 28th at 7 p.m., we're going to have Michaeline, who is a former state delegate. She's going to be talking on concept four for about 20 to 30 minutes. We'll take a quick break and then we open up for questions and answers. If you've been there, you know it gets spicy. We have great conversation, learn about the service structure, get excited. The enthusiasm's contagious and I hope to see you there. April 28th, 7 p.m. And I'll put the info in the chat. It's also on tidewaterintergroup.org. All right, thanks.
Thanks, Ebony. Any other announcements? Super excited here at Simple Actions. We just got, right before we came online, we got a confirmation from Polly P. From down in Florida. Her and her son James are going to do a family afterward workshop for us. I think she's 40, 50 years sober and her son's 30 years sober, something like that. So they're going to do family afterward. And we're going to have that on June 2nd at 7 p.m., but more details will follow. Super excited about that. All righty. That's it. Any more? Last call. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here after we close the meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. All right. So let me check the questions. This is my last plea for you guys to send in your questions. Let's see how we're doing. Oh, we got quite a few. This is awesome. Kathleen, that was amazing. I was a big fan of self-help books too. I had this fantasy that I'd be in the self-help aisle and I'd be reaching for a certain book and then then you would be reaching for that same book at the same time and I would meet you. Always wanted to meet her in the self-help aisle, the bookstore. You talked about this, but the first question that came up was, what's the hardest thing you've had to deal with in sobriety?
Well, I would say any time either of my kids have a challenge, that's what's been the hardest. And I will say that my 20-year-old daughter may be one of us. She certainly has done some things and had some experience very, very similar to mine. And so it was really, really hard to, I have been going to Al-Anon for 10 years, which was good. I was going before she hit that age. But it just really hard. It's really easy to tell a sponsee what to do when I'm not emotionally involved with it. But, having stuff happen with my kids has been, definitely the most challenging thing for me.
All right. Someone else writes, I haven't heard of a written step one. Can you explain a little bit about doing a writing step one?
Yeah. I mean, she didn't give me a lot of direction. She basically just said, write about, how you're powerless over alcohol and how your life was unmanageable. And so, and I just, I was always directed, like before I would do anything, to say a prayer, you know? And so I did say a prayer before I did that. And so I was as surprised as anybody what came out of that. You know, I mean, I would have thought that what would have come out were, you know, wild and crazy things that I had done. I didn't know that what was going to come out was, you know, what I said, how I can't predict with any certainty that I'm not going to drink at all. And I also can't predict with any certainty, you know, sometimes 3 gin and tonics does one thing, and other times the very same 3 gin and tonics does something completely different, you know? And yet, you know, my mother, who is not an alcoholic, like, I swear to you, I seriously cannot remember the last time I ever saw her take a drink of wine, but I remember eons ago, you know, if she were to have a glass of wine, that one glass of wine always did the same exact thing to her. And then on the very rare occasions where she would take a second glass of wine, she'd stop halfway through and be like, oh, I'm starting to feel it. Like, you know, and that is just not, but for her, one glass of wine always did the same thing. And the second glass of wine always did the same thing. And it just was not like that with me.
Thank you. We have a question here. I'm having trouble making amends, and it's about a tough situation with a prospective employer. What insight/tips can you give to make this process smoother about a rocky past?
Well, I mean, it's really hard to answer that when I don't know all the specifics. And I do think that really amends need to be discussed with a sponsor. And, you know, that for me, you know, for me, a sponsor is a woman who has more time than me, who has worked the steps, and who I want to be like when I grow up, if I ever grow up. You know, that's what a sponsor has always been for me. And so I've not had a problem trusting the sponsors that I've had. And I've had probably 5. I mean, I've had, I think all my previous sponsors except one have passed away, but I've not had a problem trusting them. And so I take that stuff to them and ask them what to do. I do know what it says in the big book, which is that we have to be okay, even if it's going to mean, you know, there's the story about the guy might go to jail and then there's going to be no money for the ex-wife or the current wife, and that, you know, he should be willing to go to jail if that's what it's going to mean, because that's how important it is to clean up the wreckage of our past. And I know that, you know, the thought of that is terribly daunting. I did not have a situation like that, so kind of easy for me to say that, but I think that those kinds of things need to be discussed with a sponsor. And, you know, for me, I had to be willing, again, left to my own devices, I'm going to not make an amend I need to make, and I'm going to try to go to somebody that really, and there were many people on my list who the direction was, you're to go nowhere near them, because that's the nicest thing you can do for them. And so that's how my alcoholic brain works. And that's one of the reasons I need to have a sponsor who can help me with those things.
Thank you. When you take other women through the steps, do you do that in the way that your second sponsor did, i.e. quickly, thorough, et cetera? Or do you do it differently now? Or?
Well, so my experience has been that I think everybody has to find their own way as a sponsor. And so while her abruptness and the way that she talked to me, like, I mean, I just very clearly remember soon after she was sponsoring me, I called and I don't know, I was probably whining about something. And she said, oh, for crying out loud, Kathleen, stop sitting around thinking about yourself. Like, if your bathtub's dirty, wash your bathtub. If your clothes are dirty, do your laundry. Like, and I was like, oh, you know, but like that helped me. But I don't talk to the people I sponsor like that, but this had to kind of evolve. And so I do take them through the steps in pretty much the same way. I mean, I do. I have them sit with paper and pencil so that we can, I don't necessarily tell them what all their character defects are, but I definitely stop them as we're going through to put down the names of who they need to make amends to. Quite frankly, partly because I'm going to forget. And then they're going to ask me later, remember Joe Blow from, you know, 30 years ago when I was in, I'm going to be like, no, I don't remember. So, you know, maybe that's what my sponsor was doing with me. But if we take care of them as we're going through and I'm hearing all of this, it's a lot easier for me to give some guidance on stay away or put them on the list.
Thank you. So you mentioned that your husband is also in AA. If so, how do you stay out of each other's program?
It's an excellent question. I mean, it really just got drilled into me that, I had a different sponsor at the time that I got engaged. I'll be honest with you, and I'm not saying everybody needs to do this, but for me, that second sponsor who I had for quite some time was not married. And so I sucked at having relationships. I mean, seriously. And so I needed a lot of help there. And so I needed to have somebody who was in a marriage that I respected. And again, who I want to be like, you know? And so, and it's the woman that became my sponsor. I had gone to her prior to her becoming my sponsor to talk about, you know, because when I started dating my now husband, and I really liked him, you know, and I was like, oh my God, I don't want to screw this up, you know? And I went to talk to her. She was in a happy marriage, married to another AA. And I said, how do you do it? How do you have like a happy marriage with another alcoholic? And she said, you have to have a love affair with God first and then with your husband. And I understood what she meant intellectually, but it was not until many years later that I actually really understood what she meant. But that's why she became my sponsor, because I needed a lot of help there. And she was adamant about, you have got to stay out of his program. You know, he has a sponsor and you are not it. Now, I've been with my husband for like 27 years, maybe even longer. I'm losing track, but married for almost 22. And there have been very rare occasions where my sponsor will say, you actually know him better than he knows himself. And so you need to say something to him about this. It's a very rare occasion, but again, it's with sponsor direction. And so my basic rule is he has a sponsor and I'm not it. And I'm pretty clear that he has that same direction, because we are pretty good about, you know, not telling each other like what to do. Although we definitely share this program. We both love Alcoholics Anonymous and we spend a lot of time talking about it. So.
Awesome. So how long did it take you to go through the 12 steps the first time? And how about the second time?
Yeah. So the first time I did not make it all the way through the steps because I did 5 and then decided I didn't have any defects or amends to make. And so, but I had gotten through 5, like right before my first year of sobriety. And then I got my second sponsor when I was about 2.5 years sober. And she had me move very quickly. So I would probably say like maybe a year, because it was a lot of amends to make, you know? And I will say too, that I'm not someone who believes that you need to go through the steps like at certain intervals. As a matter of fact, that second sponsor told me that if I do 10, 11, and 12, I don't ever have to go back and do 4 and 5, which sounded awesome to me. However, I have gone through them a couple other times. And both times that I did, it kind of was by accident. It was like, my husband traveled, my kids were little, I was having a hard time going to meetings. So I started a meeting at my house. We picked this format written by Dr. Paul, which is nothing more than a way to go through the big book. But when you're going through the big book, you go through the steps. So it was not like I wasn't setting out to do another 4th and 5th step. But I will say that next 4th and 5th step, I was like 18 years sober. And I mean, for me, I do not get the same thing out of doing 10 as I do from doing four. It's just not the same in my experience. And so I got a lot out of going through and doing another fourth and fifth step as outlined in the big book. I got a lot out of that and surprising things, I will say too, that I was not expecting, you know, when I did that at 18 years of sobriety. And then the same exact thing happened several years later after we moved to Northern Virginia and I was trying to get plugged in with people and my husband was traveling. So I don't believe like, oh, you have to do it every number of years. But for me, it has been helpful to do it more than once because I mean, you know, they talk about peeling the layers of the onion. And quite frankly, I would like to ask the question and get the answer, how many layers of the onion are there? Because, you know, I keep peeling, but.
I love that Dr. Paul format. It's really nice. Besides the big book and the 12 and 12, are there other books that aided you in your recovery?
Yeah. And so that's kind of funny too. So when I moved to Los Angeles, I was part of the Pacific Group for the 14 years that I lived there. And both there as well as in Baltimore, I came up with some very old school old timers, wonderful people I adore. And same with the Pacific Group, but it was a very like only conference approved literature kind of a thing. And when I moved to Northern Virginia almost 13 years ago, I started going to meetings and they were talking about Drop the Rock. And I just could not wait until I got on the phone with my sponsor to tell on them about this, you know, non-conference approved literature that they were reading and talking about. And I kid you not, and this is literally how God works in my life. Before I could say anything, my sponsor says to me, I want you to read this book. It's called Drop the Rock. And seriously? You know, and so really interesting. I mean, I would have thought myself an open-minded person, but what I've discovered over and over again is just how closed-minded I can be, you know, because there is a plethora of amazing literature out there to help us. And so, you know, Drop the Rock and Drop the Rock, The Ripple Effect are both books about AA. I mean, Drop the Rock is about 6 and 7 and Drop the Rock, The Ripple Effect is about using 10 to work 6 and 7, which is something I do. But I mean, there's a lot of other stuff out there and I consider it, you know, part of my my 11th step is that I'm seeking. And so when I really started to seek, it was actually after I did that fourth and fifth step at 18 years of sobriety, because what I discovered all over it, much to my chagrin, was fear all over it. And it shocked me. And I thought, you know, I may have a loving God and have been praying since I got here, but there's something needs to be worked on if I have this much fear in my life. And I, for the first time in my sobriety, saw, you know, that the purpose of 11 wasn't to check the box that I prayed. It was to improve my conscious contact with God. And so I, you know, set out in a whole new way to do that. And I literally would, you know, grab anything, like, you know, you go to a meeting in person at a church and they have these free little pamphlets hanging on, and, you know, I would take them and read them. Somebody would mention something at a meeting and I would get it and read it. And some of it would speak to me and other stuff was like, I was reading a foreign language or else it just really turned me off. I will say, I just happen to have this book sitting right next to me. It's called Pocketful of Miracles by Joan Borisenko. It's not as lame as it sounds. It's like a daily reader. But she uses, she's like a therapist, but also like a very spiritual person. She pulls from every faith tradition, as well as, you know, just Native American and nature. And so it's just and it's very short every day, but with some meditation practices for breathing. Because I will be honest and tell you that, and I do believe there's many, many ways to meditate, reading in the morning, walking, running, yoga. I've done all those things, but I, honest to God, did not actually sit still and meditate with any consistency until January of 2020, which was really good timing, by the way, just before the pandemic hit. But that's been something I just would have told you, I can't sit still. I can't. And so I run for meditation or whatever. But that little book has some very good practices in it from, like I said, across many different, you know, faith traditions.
Thank you. All right, we've got one here. I'm 6.5 years sober and my boyfriend just broke up with me. I have the obsession of the mind thinking about him, like thinking about a drink. I was directed to practice self-love. However, AA suggests to help others. What is your experience with emotional sobriety?
Oh, that's a really good question. So there's also a book put out by The Grapevine. Actually, there's a couple different, it's like emotional sobriety, and then there's like a second one, and I don't know how many there are. But anyway, it's, I actually, so when I first got sober, they said to me, pray on your knees because you'll know why you're there. And, you know, say to God, I'm powerless over alcohol. Please help me stay sober today. And at the end of the day to say thank you. And so I still do that because it works. And I don't ever want to forget that. But I also ask for emotional sobriety because, you know, I've had white knuckle physical sobriety and it's no fun. Like, I don't really want to be sober that way. And so I want to have emotional sobriety. Now, I will say that, and this, it seems like this was just a topic at a meeting I went to sometime in the last week, but like, you know, I loved, well, I called it excitement. Other people call it chaos, but so I continued to have excitement and chaos for many years into my sobriety. And I've been at a point for a while where I want emotional sobriety. I don't want that excitement anymore, but I totally get the obsessive thinking. And as a matter of fact, there was just something, my daughter, who came out of the womb, like, and who, like, if I said go right, she'd go left, you know, and, has had some challenges with her boyfriend. And she's actually been coming to me, which is like so awesome. And I found that really all I have to say is what I learned in program, right? Don't play games, be honest, and make amends for your part. But what, and this is where I tell you, my kids are my biggest challenge. She gave me an inch and I took a mile. And man, was I in there and I was invested with her, like as if she were my sponsee, brand new newcomer sponsee living with me, you know? I mean, I became so entrenched and really obsessed with the whole everything. And mind you, she was calling me or she was coming to talk to me, but I just let it take up too much space in my head. And so I know what you mean. And it reminded me of the fact that I have done that even in sobriety with different things. And it is not a good place to be because it's really hard to get out of that place. And so I'm in a better place now. It's not 100% gone because I literally woke up and started thinking about it again. I was like, get out of bed and go talk to God. Like, don't sit here and do this. And it's, you know, I mean, all throughout the book, it says, if we have a problem with this, think of somebody else. If we have a problem with this, think of somebody else. If we have a problem with this, so the answer to whatever is to think of somebody else. And so that's what I've had to pray so hard. And a lot of times throughout the day, especially when I first realized how crazy my head was and that I needed to get out of it. But I can get there so fast, but I can't get out of there very fast at all, you know? And so it's really hard. It's really, really, really hard to get out of that place, which is why what I know after 32 years is it's a whole lot easier to just not go to the obsessive place in the first place. And I totally get that it's hard to do that with a breakup. I get that. But I used to think self-love sounded like it would make me like vomit. Now I totally believe in that today. However, it doesn't mean what I used to think it meant, which made me want to vomit, really, because self-love means like taking care of health. If I'm hungry, I eat. If I'm angry, I talk to somebody. If I'm lonely, I reach out to somebody. If I'm tired, I sleep. I mean, these are, you know, self-love is a very basic, I mean, it can mean more things, but on a very basic level, I need to take care of myself by sleeping, eating right, doing some kind of exercise, taking care of my program, you know, so meetings and sponsees and sponsor and being of service and praying and all that other stuff. So you can do the two things together, because the solution over and over says is to get out of myself, but I have to take care of myself or I'm going to be, I'm not in good shape if I have halt going on. So.
Thank you. How have you kept your enthusiasm and connection with others alive during the pandemic?
Well, number one, I've accepted life on life's terms for the most part. It doesn't mean I've not had days where I've been like, oh my God, I can't stand this. I got to get out of here. It doesn't mean that. But I have witnessed, I'm going to be very careful how I say this. They wouldn't even be on this meeting, so I'm not going to be offending them. But I've witnessed people who are so pissed about what's going on that they're, I don't know, not going on Zoom meetings. And so basically, you know, would I rather be at in-person meetings and seeing people and hugging people? Yes. But this is what we have. And thank God we have it. You know, so first of all, in the beginning, I went to more meetings because it was like, this is kind of crazy. And so like, you know, there's Zoom meetings all the time. You can go to Zoom meetings in every country and at any time of day. And so I was going to extra meetings. And then I noticed that I was like developing a tic, you know, because being on a computer all the time is for me, not really a good, it's just not a good idea. So then I had to like up the amount of like meditating I was doing. But I never stopped doing what I was doing before. So I never stopped going to a minimum of 4 meetings a week. I never stopped talking to my sponsor. I never stopped talking to the women I sponsor. I never stopped praying. And I do actually have a couple service positions that still operate in the Zoom format. So I have to treat my alcoholism whether there's a pandemic or not. And so you just have to do it in the, I think for me, I've just had to do it in the way that it's available.
Thank you. We are out of time. I hope this was pleasant for you, Kathleen. This is a quick hour and a half from my perspective. I wonder if you maybe say a couple of words about being a member of a home group before we close.
Absolutely. Yeah. Having a home group has also been a really important part of my sobriety. And as a friend of mine says, it's like my AA address, which means this is where you will find me, except on the occasional Sunday night when I speak somewhere else. This is where you know you can find me. I'm going to be there every week. I have a service position there. I love the definition. It's my AA address. You know, it's my home. And yes, in the pandemic, I've been able to go to all kinds of meetings that are awesome, back at Pacific Group in Los Angeles, all kinds of awesome meetings and seeing people I wouldn't be able to see, you know, outside of the pandemic. But my home group is my home. It's my home in AA. And it's where I've met most of the women I sponsor, not all of them, but most of them, you know, so.
All right. Thank you so much. You're so generous with your time. Everybody will have the opportunity to thank Kathleen again after the Lord's Prayer. And I wonder if Leanne would read the last 3 paragraphs on page 164, please.
My name's Leanne. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you. Vision for you. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you very much. Thank everybody, Larry, for wrangling the questions, everyone who showed up, Kathleen, for your wonderful talk. How about we circle up virtually and feel free to unmute yourselves. We'll have a nice static-filled, confusing version of the Lord's Prayer. Won't that be fun? Moment of silence. Whose Father?
Our Father.
Who art in heaven,
hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done.
On earth as it is in heaven.
Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Woohoo! Thank you so much. That was wonderful.
Thank you for having me.